do it anymore." He leaned closer to her, not picking her up yet, not touching her. "Don't you do it anymore, because it is a bad thing. Da!" And that was all the heartbreak he could stand to inflict. All the horror, all the fear. He picked her up, held her, walked her back and forth until, a very long time later, her sobs tapered off to irregular hitchings of her chest and sniffles. When he looked at her, she was asleep with her cheek on his shoulder. He put her on the couch and went to the phone in the kitchen and called Quincy. Quincy didn't want to talk. He was working for a large aircraft corporation in that year of 1975, and in the notes that accompanied each of his yearly Christmas cards to the McGees, he described his job as vice president in charge of stroking. When the men who made the airplanes had problems, they were supposed to go see Quincy. Quincy would help them with their problems, feelings of alienation, identity crises, maybe just a feeling that their jobs were dehumanizing them. And they wouldn't go back to the line and put the widget where the wadget was supposed to go, and therefore the planes wouldn't crash and the world would continue to be safe for democracy. For this, Quincy made $32,000 a year, $17,000 more than Andy made. "And I don't feel a bit guilty," he had written. "I consider it a small salary to extract for keeping America afloat almost single-handed." That was Quincy, as sardonically funny as ever. Except he hadn't been sardonic, and he hadn't been funny that day when Andy called from Ohio, with his daughter sleeping on the couch and the smell of burned bear and singed carpeting in his nostrils. "I've heard things," Quincy said finally, when he saw that Andy wasn't going to let him off without something. "But sometimes people listen in on phones, old buddy. It's the era of Watergate." "I'm scared," Andy said. "Vicky's scared, and Charlie's scared, too. What have you heard, Quincy?" "Once upon a time, there was an experiment in which 12 people participated," Quincy said. "About 6 years ago. Do you remember that?"
"I remember it," Andy said grimly.
"There aren't many of those 12 people left. There were 4 the last I heard, and 2 of them married each other."
"Yes," Andy said, but inside he felt growing horror. Only 4 left? What was Quincy talking about?
"I understand. One of them can bend keys and shut doors without even touching them." Quincy's voice, thin, coming across 2,000 miles of telephone cable, coming through switching stations, through open relay points, through junction boxes in Nevada, Idaho, Colorado, Iowa. A million places to tap into Quincy's voice.
"Yes," he said, straining to keep his voice level.
And he thought of Vicky, who could sometimes turn on the radio or turn off the TV without going anywhere near it. And Vicky was apparently not even aware she was doing those things. "Oh, yes, he's for real," Quincy was saying. "He's, what would you say, a documented case. It hurts his head if he does those things too often, but he can do them. They keep him in a little room with a door he can't open and a lock he can't bend. They do tests on him. He bends keys. He shuts doors. And I understand he's nearly crazy."
"Oh, my God," Andy said faintly.
"He's part of the peace effort, so it's all right if he goes crazy," Quincy went on. "He's going crazy so 220 million Americans can stay safe and free. Do you understand?"
"Yes," Andy had whispered.
"What about the 2 people who got married?"
"Nothing,
so far as they know. They live quietly in some quiet middle American state like Ohio. There's maybe a yearly check on them, just to see if they're doing anything like bending keys or closing doors without touching them, or doing funny little mentalist routines at the local backyard carnival for muscular dystrophy. Good thing those people can't do anything like that, isn't it, Andy?" Andy closed his eyes and smelled burned cloth. Sometimes Charlie would pull open the fridge door, look in, and then crawl off again. And if Vicky was ironing, she would glance at the fridge door and it would swing shut again. All without her being aware that she was doing anything strange. That was sometimes. At other times it didn't seem to work, and she would leave her ironing and close the refrigerator door herself. Or turn off the radio or turn on the TV.
Vicky couldn't bend keys or read thoughts or fly or start fires or predict the future. She could sometimes shut a door from across the room, and that was about the extent of it. Sometimes after she had done several of these things, Andy had noticed that she would complain of a headache or an upset stomach, and whether that was a physical reaction or some sort of muttered warning from her subconscious, Andy didn't know. Her ability to do these things got maybe a little stronger around the time of her period. Such small things, and so infrequently, that Andy had come to think of them as normal. As for himself, well, he could push people. There was no real name for it. Perhaps auto-hypnosis came closest. Andy couldn't do it often because it gave him headaches. Most days he could forget completely that he wasn't utterly normal, and never really had been since that day in room 70 of Jason Gearney. He closed his eyes, and on the dark field inside his eyelids, he saw that comma-shaped blood stain and the non-words, Cor Ossum. "Yes, it's a good thing," Quincy went on, as if Andy had agreed. "Or they might put them in two little rooms where they could work full-time to keep 220 million Americans safe and free." "A good thing," Andy agreed. "Those 12 people," Quincy said, "maybe they gave those 12 people a drug they didn't fully understand. It might have been that someone, a certain mad doctor, might have deliberately misled them. Or maybe he thought he was misleading them, and they were deliberately leading him on. It doesn't matter." "No. So this drug was given to them, and maybe it changed their chromosomes a little bit. Or a lot. Or who knows? And maybe two of them got married and decided to have a baby. And maybe the baby got something more than her eyes and his mouth. Wouldn't they be interested in that child?" "I bet they would," Andy said, now so frightened he was having trouble talking at all. He'd already decided that he would not tell Vicky about calling Quincy. "It's like you got lemon, and that's nice, and you got meringue, and that's nice too, but when you put them together, you've got a whole new taste treat. I bet they'd want to see just what that child could do. They might just want to take it and put it in a little room and see if it could help make the world safe for democracy. And I think that's all I want to say, old buddy, except keep your head down." 24. Voices in a haunted room. Keep your head down. He turned his head on the motel pillow and looked at Charlie, who was sleeping deeply. "Charlie, kid, what are we going to do? Where can we go and be left alone? How is this going to end?" No answer to any of these questions. And at last he slept, while not so far away, a green car cruised through the dark, still hoping to come upon a big man with broad shoulders and a corduroy jacket, and a little girl with blonde hair in red pants and a green blouse. Longmont, Virginia. The Shop. 1. Two handsome southern plantation homes faced each other across a long and rolling grass lawn that was crisscrossed by a few gracefully looping bike paths and a two-lane crushed gravel drive that came over the hill from the main road. Off to one side of one of these houses was a large barn, painted a bright red and trimmed spotless white. Near the other was a long stable, done in the same handsome red, with white trim. Some of the best horse flesh in the South was quartered here. Between the barn and the stable was a wide, shallow duck pond, calmly reflecting the sky. In the 1860s, the original owners of these two homes had gone off and got themselves killed in the war, and all survivors of both families were dead now. The two estates had been consolidated into one piece of government property in 1954. It was Shop headquarters. At 9:10 on a sunny October day, the day after Andy and Charlie left New York for Albany in a taxicab, an elderly man with kindly, sparkling eyes and wearing a woolen British driving cap on his head biked toward one of the houses. Behind him, over the second knoll, was the checkpoint he had come through after a computer ID system had okayed his thumbprint. The checkpoint was inside a double run of barbed wire. The outer run, 7 feet high, was marked every 60 feet by signs that read, "Caution, government property, low electric charge runs through this fence." During the day, the charge was indeed low. At night, the on-property generator boosted it to a lethal voltage. And each morning, a squad of 5 groundskeepers circled it in little electric golf carts, picking up the bodies of crisped rabbits, moles, birds, groundhogs, an occasional skunk lying in a pool of smell, sometimes a deer. And twice, human beings, equally cooked. The space between the outer and inner runs of barbed wire was 10 feet. Day and night, guard dogs circled the installation in this run. The guard dogs were Dobermans, and they had been trained to stay away from the electrified wire. At each corner of the installation, there were guard towers, also built of spanking red barn board and trimmed in white. They were manned by personnel who were expert in the use of various items of death-dealing hardware. The whole place was monitored by TV cameras, and the views these various cameras presented were constantly scanned by computer. The Longmont facility was secure. The elderly man biked on with a smile for the people he passed. An old, bald-headed man in a baseball cap was walking a thin-ankled filly. He raised his hand and called, "Hi, Cap. Ain't this some kind of a day?" "Knock your eye out," the man on the bike agreed. "Have a good one, Henry." He reached the front of the northernmost of the two homes, dismounted his bike, and put down its kickstand. He breathed deeply of the mild morning air, then trotted spryly up the wide porch steps and between the broad Doric columns. He opened the door and stepped into the wide receiving hall. A young woman with red hair sat behind a desk, a statistics analysis book open in front of her. One hand was holding her place in the book. The other was in her desk drawer, lightly touching a .38 Smith & Wesson. "Good morning, Josie," the elderly gent said. "Hi, Cap. You're running a little behind, aren't you?" Pretty girls could get away with this. If it had been Duane's day on the front desk, he could not have done. Cap was not a supporter of women's liberation. "My top gear's sticking, darling." He put his thumb in the proper slot. Something in the console thudded heavily, and a green light fluttered and then remained steady on Josie's board. "You be good now." "Well, I'll be careful," she said archly and crossed her legs. Cap roared laughter and walked down the hall. She watched him go, wondering for a moment if she should have told him that that creepy old man Wanless had come in some 20 minutes ago. He'd know soon enough, she supposed, and sighed. What a way to screw up the start of a perfectly fine day, having to talk to an old spook like that. But she supposed that a person like Cap, who held a position of great responsibility, had to take the sour with the sweet. 2. Cap's office was at the back of the house. A large bay window gave a magnificent view of the back lawn, the barn, and the duck pond, which was partially screened with alders. Rich McKeon was halfway down the lawn, sitting astride a miniature tractor lawnmower. Cap stood looking at him with his arms crossed behind his back for a moment, and then went over to the Mr. Coffee in the corner. He poured some coffee in his USN cup, added Cremora, and then sat down and thumbed the intercom. "Hi, Rachel," he said. "Hello, Cap. Dr. Wanless is..." "I knew it," Cap said. "I knew it. I could smell that old whore the minute I came in. Shall I tell him you're just too busy today?" "Don't tell him any such thing," Cap said stoutly. "Just let him sit out there in the yellow parlor the whole frigging morning. If he doesn't decide to go home, I suppose I can see him before lunch." "All right, sir." Problem solved. For Rachel, anyway, Cap thought with a touch of resentment. Wanless wasn't really her problem at all. And the fact was, Wanless was getting to be an embarrassment. He'd outlived both his usefulness and his influence. Well, there was always the Maui compound. And then there was Rainbird. Cap felt a little inward shudder at that. And he wasn't a man who shuddered easily. He held down the intercom toggle again. "I'll want the entire McGee file again, Rachel. And at 10:30 I want to see Al Steinowitz. If Wanless is still here when I finish with Al, you can send him in." "Very good, Cap." Cap sat back, steepled his fingers, and looked across the room at the picture of George Patton on the wall. Patton was standing astride the top hatch of a tank as if he thought he were Duke Wayne or someone. "It's a hard life if you don't weaken," he told Patton's image and sipped his coffee. 3. Rachel brought the file in on a whisper-wheeled library cart 10 minutes later. There were 6 boxes of papers and reports, 4 boxes of photographs. There were telephone transcripts as well. The McGee phone had been bugged since 1978. "Thanks, Rachel." "You're welcome. Mr. Steinowitz will be here at 10:30.
"Of course he will. Has Wanless died yet?"
"I'm afraid not," she said, smiling. "He's just sitting out there and watching Henry walk the horses."
"Shredding his goddamn cigarettes?"
Rachel covered her mouth like a schoolgirl, giggled, and nodded. "He's gone through half a pack already." Cap grunted. Rachel left, and he turned to the files. He'd been through them how many times in the last 11 months? 12? 24? He had the extractor nearly by heart. And if Al was right, he would have the 2 remaining McGees under detection by the end of the week. The thought caused a hot little trickle of excitement in his belly. He began leafing through the McGee file at random, pulling a sheet here, reading a snatch there. It was his way of plugging back into the situation. His conscious mind was in neutral, his subconscious in high gear. What he wanted now was not detail, but to put his hand to the whole thing. As baseball players say, he needed to find the handle. Here was a memo from Wanless himself, a younger Wanless. But they had all been younger then. Dated September 12, 1968. Half a paragraph caught Cap's eye. "Of an enormous importance in the continuing study of controllable psychic phenomena. Further testing on animals would be counterproductive, see Overleaf 1. And, as I emphasized at the group meeting this summer, testing on convicts or any deviant personality might lead to very real problems if Lot 6 is even fractionally as powerful as we suspect, see Overleaf 2. I therefore continue to recommend..." "You continue to recommend that we feed it to controlled groups of college students under all outstanding contingency plans for failure," Cap thought. There had been no waffling on Wanless's part in those days. No, indeed. His motto in those days had been full speed ahead and devil take the hindmost. 12 people had been tested. 2 of them had died, one during the test, one shortly afterward. 2 had gone hopelessly insane, and both of them were maimed. 1 blind, 1 suffering from psychotic paralysis, both of them confined at the Maui compound, where they would remain until their miserable lives ended. So, then there were 8. 1 of them had died in a car accident in 1972, a car accident that was almost certainly no accident at all, but suicide. Another had leaped from the roof of the Cleveland Post Office in 1973, and there was no question at all about that one. He had left a note saying he couldn't stand the pictures in his head any longer. The Cleveland police had diagnosed it as suicidal depression and paranoia. Cap and the shop had diagnosed it as lethal Lot 6 hangover. And that had left 6. 3 others had committed suicide between 1974 and 1977, for a known total of 4 suicides and a probable total of 5. Almost half the class, you might say. All 4 of the definite suicides had seemed perfectly normal right up to the time they had used the gun or the rope or jumped from the high place. But who knew what they might have been going through? Who really knew? So then there were 3. Since 1977, when the long-dormant Lot 6 project had suddenly got red-hot again, a fellow named James Richardson, who now lived in Los Angeles, had been under constant covert surveillance. In 1969, he had taken part in the Lot 6 experiment, and during the course of the drug's influence, he had demonstrated the same startling range of talents as the rest of them. Telekinesis, thought transference, and maybe the most interesting manifestation of all, at least from the shop's specialized point of view, mental domination. But, as had happened with the others, James Richardson's drug-induced powers seemed to have disappeared completely with the wearing off of the drug. Follow-up interviews in 1971, 1973, and 1975 had shown nothing. Even Wanless had had to admit that, and he was a fanatic on the subject of Lot 6. steady computer readouts on a random basis, and they were a lot less random since the McGee thing had started to happen, had shown no indication at all that Richardson was using any sort of psi power, either consciously or unconsciously. He had graduated in 1971, drifted west through a series of lower echelon managerial jobs, no mental domination there, and now worked for the Telemine Corporation. Also, he was a fucking faggot. Cap sighed. They were continuing to keep an eye on Richardson, but Cap had been personally convinced that the man was a washout. And that left two, Andy McGee and his wife. The serendipity of their marriage had not been lost on the shop or on Wanless, who had begun to bombard the office with memos suggesting that any offspring of that marriage would bear close watching, counting his chickens before they had hatched, you could say. And on more than one occasion, Cap had toyed with the idea of telling Wanless they had learned Andy McGee had had a vasectomy. That would have shut the old bastard up. By then, Wanless had had his stroke and was effectively useless. Really, nothing but a nuisance. There had been only the one Lot 6 experiment. The results had been so disastrous that the cover-up had been massive and complete. And expensive. The order came down from on high to impose an indefinite moratorium on further testing. Wanless had plenty to scream about that day, Cap thought, and scream he had. But there had been no sign at all that the Russians or any other world power was interested in drug-induced psionics. And the top brass had concluded that in spite of some positive results, Lot 6 was a blind alley. Looking at the long-term results, one of the scientists who had worked on the project compared it to dropping a jet engine into an old Ford. It went like hell, all right, until it hit the first obstacle. Give us another 10,000 years of evolution, this fellow had said, and we'll try it again. Part of the problem had been that when the drug-induced psi powers were at their height, the test subjects had also been tripping out of their skulls. No control was possible. And coming out the other side, the top brass had been nearly shitting their pants. Covering up the death of an agent, or even of a bystander to an operation, that was one thing. Covering up the death of a student who had suffered a heart attack, the disappearance of two others, and lingering traces of hysteria and paranoia in yet others, that was a different matter altogether. All of them had friends and associates, even if one of the requirements by which the test subjects had been picked was a scarcity of close relatives. The costs and the risks had been enormous. They'd involved nearly $700,000 in hush money and the sanction of at least one person, the godfather of the fellow who had clawed his eyes out. The godfather just would not quit. He was going to get to the root of the matter. As it turned out, the only place the godfather had got was to the bottom of the Baltimore Trench, where he presumably still was, with two cement blocks tied around whatever remained of his legs. And still, a great deal of it, too damn much, had just been luck. So the Lot 6 project had been shelved with a continuing yearly budget allotment. The money was used to continue random surveillance on the survivors in case something turned up, some pattern. Eventually, one had. Cap hunted through a folder of photographs and came up with an 8x10 glossy black and white of the girl. It had been taken 3 years ago when she was four and attending the free children's nursery school in Harrison. The picture had been taken with a telephoto lens from the back of a bakery van and later blown up and cropped to turn a picture of a lot of boys and girls at playtime into a portrait of a smiling little girl with her pigtails flying and the pistol grip of a jump rope in each hand. Cap looked at this picture sentimentally for some time. Wanless, in the aftermath of his stroke, had discovered fear. Wanless now thought the little girl would have to be sanctioned. And although Wanless was among the outs these days, there were those who concurred with his opinion, those who were among the ins. Cap hoped like hell that it wouldn't come to that. He had three grandchildren himself, two of them just about Charlene McGee's age. Of course, they would have to separate the girl from her father, probably permanently, and he would almost certainly have to be sanctioned, after he had served his purpose, of course. It was 10:15. He buzzed Rachel.
Is Albert Steinowitz here yet?
Just this minute arrived, sir.
Very good. Send him in, please.
4.
I want you to take personal charge of the end game, Al.
Very good, Cap.
Albert Steinowitz was a small man with a yellow-pale complexion and very black hair. In earlier years, he had sometimes been mistaken for the actor Victor Jory. Cap had worked with Steinowitz off and on for nearly 8 years. In fact, they had come over from the Navy together. And to him, Al had always looked like a man about to enter the hospital for a terminal stay. He smoked constantly, except in here, where it wasn't allowed. He walked with a slow, stately stride that invested him with a strange kind of dignity. And impenetrable dignity is a rare attribute in any man. Cap, who saw all the medical records of Section 1 agents, knew that Albert's dignified walk was bogus. He suffered badly from hemorrhoids and had been operated on for them twice. He'd refused a third operation because it might mean a colostomy bag on his leg for the rest of his life. His dignified walk always made Cap think of the fairy tale about the mermaid who wanted to be a woman and the price she paid for legs and feet. Cap imagined that her walk had been rather dignified, too.
How soon can you be in Albany? He asked Al now.
An hour after I leave here.
Good. I won't keep you long. What's the status up there?
Albert folded his small, slightly yellow hands in his lap.
The state police are cooperating nicely. All highways leading out of Albany have been roadblocked.
The blocks are set up in concentric circles with Albany County Airport at their center, radius of 35 miles.
You're assuming they didn't hitch a ride?
We have to, Albert said. If they hooked a ride with someone who took them 200 miles or so, of course we'll have to start all over again. But I'm betting they're inside that circle.
Oh? Why is that, Albert?
Cap leaned forward. Albert Steinowitz was, without a doubt, the best agent, except maybe for Rainbird, in the shop's employ. He was bright, intuitive, and ruthless when the job demanded that.
Partly hunch, Albert said. Partly the stuff we got back from the computer when we fed in everything we knew about the last 3 years of Andrew McGee's life.
We asked it to pull out any and all patterns that might apply to this ability he's supposed to have.
He does have it, Al, Cap said gently. That's what makes this operation so damned delicate.
All right, he has it, Al said. But the computer readouts suggest that his ability to use it is extremely limited. If he overuses it, it makes him sick.
Right, we're counting on that.
He was running a storefront operation in New York, a Dale Carnegie kind of thing. Cap nodded. Confidence Associates, an operation aimed mainly at timid executives, enough to keep him and the girl in bread, milk, and meat, but not much more.
We've debriefed his last group, Albert Steinowitz said. There were 16 of them, and each of them paid a split tuition fee. $100 at enrollment, $100 more halfway through the course if they felt the course was helping them. Of course, they all did.
Cap nodded. McGee's talent was admirably suited for investing people with confidence. He literally pushed them into it.
We've fed their answers to several key questions into the computer. The questions were, did you feel better about yourself and the Confidence Associates course at specific times? Can you remember days at work following your Confidence Associates meeting when you felt like a tiger?
Have you
felt like a tiger? Cap asked.
Jesus, you asked them if they felt like tigers?
The computer suggests the wording.
Okay, go on.
The third key question was, have you had any specific, measurable success at your job since taking the Confidence Associates course?
That was the question they could all respond to with the most objectivity and reliability, because people tend to remember the day they got the raise or the pat on the back from the boss. They were eager to talk.
I found it a little spooky, Cap. He sure did what he promised. Of the 16, 11 of them have had promotions. 11! Of the other 5, 3 are in jobs where promotions are made only at certain set times. No one is arguing McGee's capability, Kep said. Not anymore. Okay. I'm getting back around to the point here. It was a 6-week course. Using the answers to the key questions, the computer came up with 4 spike dates. That is, days when McGee probably supplemented all the usual hip hip hooray you can do it if you try stuff with a good hard push. The dates we have are August 17th, September 1st, September 19th, and October 4th. Proving? Well, he pushed that cab driver last night, pushed him hard. That dude is still rocking and reeling. We figure Andy McGee is tipped over. Sick. Maybe immobilized. Albert looked at Cap steadily. Computer gave us a 26% probability that he's dead. What? Well, he's overdone it before and wound up in bed. He's doing something to his brain. God knows what. Giving himself pinprick hemorrhages, maybe. It could be a progressive thing. The computer figures there's slightly better than a 1 in 4 chance he's dead. Either of a heart attack, or, more probably, a stroke. He had to use it before he was recharged, Cap said. Albert nodded and took something out of his pocket. It was encased in limp plastic. He passed it to Cap, who looked at it, and then passed it back. What's that supposed to mean? He asked. Not that much, Al said, looking at the bill in its plastic envelope meditatively. Just what McGee paid his cab fare with. He went to Albany from New York City on a $1 bill, huh? Cap took it back and looked at it with renewed interest. Cab fares sure must be... What the hell? He dropped the plastic-encased bill on his desk as if it were hot and sat back, blinking. You too, huh? Al said. Did you see it? Christ, I don't know what I saw, Cap said and reached for the ceramic box where he kept his acid neutralizers. For just a second, it didn't look like a $1 bill at all. But now it does. Cap peered at the bill. It sure does. That's George all... Christ! He sat back so violently this time that he almost wrapped the back of his head on the dark wood paneling behind his desk. He looked at Al. The face seemed to change for a second there. Grew glasses or something. Is it a trick? Oh, it's a hell of a good trick, Al said, taking the bill back. I saw it as well, although I don't anymore. I think I've adjusted to it now, although I'll be damned if I know how. It's not there, of course. It's just some kind of crazy hallucination. But I even made the face. It's Ben Franklin. You got this from the cab driver? Cap asked, looking at the bill, fascinated, waiting for the change again. But it was only George Washington. Al laughed. Yeah, he said. We took the bill and gave him a check for $500. He's better off, really. Why? Ben Franklin isn't on the 500. He's on the 100. Apparently, McGee didn't know. Let me see that again. Al handed the $1 bill back to Cap, and Cap stared fixedly at it for almost a full 2 minutes. Just as he was about to hand it back, it flickered again, unsettling. But at least this time he felt that the flicker was definitely in his mind and not in the bill or on it or whatever. I'll tell you something else, Cap said. I'm not sure, but I don't think Franklin's wearing glasses on his currency portrait either. Otherwise, it's... He trailed off, not sure how to complete the thought. Goddamn weird came to mind, and he dismissed it. Yeah, Al said. Whatever it is, the effect is dissipating. This morning I showed it to maybe 6 people. A couple of them thought they saw something, but not like that cab driver and the girl he lives with. So you're figuring he pushed too hard? Yes. I doubt if he could keep going. They may have slept in the woods or in an outlying motel. They may have broken into a summer cabin in the area. But I think they're around, and we'll be able to put the arm on them without too much trouble. How many men do you need to do the job? We've got what we need, Al said. Counting the state police, there are better than 700 people in on this little house party. Priority A1A. They're going door to door and house to house. We've checked every hotel and motel in the immediate Albany area already. Better than 40 of them. We're spreading into the neighboring towns now. A man and a little girl. They stick out like a sore thumb. We'll get them. Or the girl, if he's dead. Albert stood up. And I think I ought to get on it. I'd like to be there when it goes down. Of course you would. Bring them to me, Al. I will, Albert said and walked toward the door. Albert. He turned back, a small man with an unhealthy yellow complexion. Who is on the 500? Did you check that out? Albert Steinowitz smiled. McKinley, he said. He was assassinated. He went out, closing the door gently behind him, leaving Cap to consider. 5. 10 minutes later, Cap thumbed the intercom again. Is Rainberg back from Venice yet, Rachel? As of yesterday, Rachel said. And Cap fancied he could hear the distaste even in Rachel's carefully cultivated boss secretary tones. Is he here or at Sanibel? The shop maintained an R&R facility on Sanibel Island, Florida. There was a pause as Rachel checked with a computer. Longmont, Cap. As of 1800 yesterday. Sleeping off the jet lag, perhaps. Have someone wake him up, Cap said. I'd like to see him when Wanless leaves. Always assuming Wanless is still here? As of 15 minutes ago, he was. All right. Let's say Rainbird at noon. Yes, sir. You're a good girl, Rachel. Thank you, sir. She sounded touched. Cap liked her. Liked her very much. Send in Dr. Wanless, please, Rachel. He settled back, joined his hands in front of him, and thought, for my sins. 6. Dr. Joseph Wanless had suffered his stroke on the same day Richard Nixon announced his resignation of the presidency, August 8, 1974. It had been a cerebral accident of moderate severity, and he had never come all the way back physically, nor mentally, in Cap's opinion. It was only following the stroke that Wanless's interest in the Lot 6 experiment and follow-up had become constant and obsessive. He came into the room leaning over a cane, the light from the bay window catching his round, rimless glasses and making them glare blankly. His left hand was a drawn-up claw. The left side of his mouth drifted in a constant glacial sneer. Rachel looked at Cap sympathetically over Wanless's shoulder, and Cap nodded that she could go. She did, closing the door quietly. "The good doctor," Cap said humorlessly. "How does it progress?" Wanless asked, sitting down with a grunt. "Classified," Cap said. "You know that, Joe. What can I do for you today?" "I have seen the activity around this place," Wanless said, ignoring Cap's question. "What else had I to do while I cooled my heels all morning?" "If you come without an appointment..." "You think you nearly have them again," Wanless said. "Why else that hatchet man Steinowitz?" "Well, maybe you do. Maybe so. But you have thought so before, haven't you?" "What do you want, Joe?" Cap didn't like to be reminded of past failures. They had actually had the girl for a while. The men who had been involved in that were still not operational, and maybe never would be. "What do I always want?" Wanless asked, hunched over his cane. "Oh, Christ," Cap thought. "The old fuck's going to wax rhetorical. Why do I stay alive? To persuade you to sanction them both. To sanction that James Richardson as well. To sanction the ones on Maui. Extreme sanction, Captain Hollister. Expunge them. Wipe them off the face of the earth." Cap sighed. Wanless gestured toward the library cart with his claw hand and said, "You've been through the files again, I see." "I have them almost by heart," Cap said, and then smiled a little. He'd been eating and drinking Lot 6 for the last year. It had been a constant item on the agenda at every meeting during the 2 years before that. So maybe Oneless wasn't the only obsessive character around here at that. The difference is I get paid for it. With Oneless, it's a hobby. A dangerous hobby. You read them, but you don't learn, Oneless said. Let me try once more to convert you to the way of truth, Captain Hollister. Cap began to protest, and then the thought of Rainbird and his noon appointment came to mind, and his face smoothed out. It became calm, even sympathetic. All right, he said. Fire when ready, Gridley. You still think I'm crazy, don't you? A lunatic. You said that, not I. It would be well for you to remember that I was the first one to suggest a testing program with dilysergic triune acid. I have days when I wish you hadn't, Cap said. If he closed his eyes, he could still see Wanless's first report, a 200-page prospectus on a drug that had first been known as DLT, then, among the technicians involved, as booster acid, and finally as Lot 6. Cap's predecessor had okayed the original project. That gentleman had been buried in Arlington with full military honors 6 years ago. All I am saying is that my opinion should carry some weight, Wanless said. He sounded tired this morning. His words were slow and furry. The twisted sneer on the left side of his mouth did not move as he spoke. I'm listening, Cap said. So far as I am able to tell, I am the only psychologist or medical man who still has your ear at all. Your people have become blinded by one thing and one thing only. What this man and this girl can mean to the security of America, and possibly to the future balance of power. From what we've been able to tell by following this McGee's back trail, he is a kind of benign Rasputin. He can make... Wanless droned on, but Cap lost him temporarily. Benign Rasputin, he thought. Purple as the phrase was, he rather liked it. He wondered what Wanless would say if told the computer had issued 1 in 4 odds that McGee had sanctioned himself getting out of New York City. Probably would have been overjoyed. And if he had showed Wanless that strange bill, probably have another stroke, Cap thought, and covered his mouth to hide a smile. It is the girl I am primarily worried about, Wanless told him for the 20th, 30th, 50th time. McGee and Tomlinson marrying. 1,000-to-1 chance. It should have been prevented at all costs. Yet who could have foreseen? You were all in favor of it at the time, Cap said, and then added dryly, I do believe you'd have given the bride away if they'd asked you. None of us realized, Wanless muttered. It took a stroke to make me see. Lot 6 was nothing but a synthetic copy of a pituitary extract, after all. An incredibly powerful painkiller hallucinogen that we did not understand then, and that we don't understand now. We know, or at least we are 99% sure, that the natural counterpart of this substance is responsible in some way for the occasional flashes of psiability that nearly all human beings demonstrate from time to time. A surprisingly wide range of phenomena. Precognition, telekinesis, mental domination, bursts of superhuman strength, temporary control over the sympathetic nervous system. Did you know that the pituitary gland becomes suddenly overactive in nearly all biofeedback experiments? Cap did. Wanless had told him this and all the rest, times without number. But there was no need to answer. Wanless's rhetoric was in full fine flower this morning, the sermon well launched, and Cap was disposed to listen, this one last time. Let the old man have his turn at bat. For Wanless, it was the bottom of the ninth. Yes, this is true, Wanless answered himself. It's active in biofeedback. It's active in REM sleep. And people with damaged pituitaries rarely dream normally. People with damaged pituitaries have a tremendously high incidence of brain tumors and leukemia. It's a pituitary gland, Captain Hollister. It is, speaking in terms of evolution, the oldest endocrine gland in the human body. During early adolescence, it dumps many times its own weight in glandular secretions into the bloodstream. It's a terribly important gland, a terribly mysterious gland. If I believed in the human soul, Captain Hollister, I would say it resides within the pituitary gland. Cap grunted.